Okay, hello everyone. I hope you had a productive morning. I'm Joakim Westerholm, professor in finance here at UNI Sydney, and I'm really delighted to introduce you to Andrea Rischetto from the Reserve Bank of Australia. He's here to give us a talk on financial stability and the financial health of the Australian mortgagees. Just a really condensed background, I mean, Andrea has had a stellar career at the Reserve Bank, where we can see her name on a lot of research papers that's published widely, and as a solid background to that, she studied at University of Queensland and London School of Economics. Seems very interesting, those kind of things, being academics. Okay, Andrea, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Well, look, good afternoon, and thank you for having me here today to speak at this conference. The topic, banking and financial stability, is an area of great interest to the RBA, given our long-standing mandate to contribute to financial stability. So thank you all for your interest and work in this important area and for contributing to our collective understanding of the issues. Today I'll be talking about financial stability and the financial health of Australian households with a mortgage. There has understandably been a lot of focus on this issue of late, with many households facing substantial financial pressures from high inflation and higher interest rates. Some of the households feeling these pressures most acutely are those with lower incomes, including many renters. Fitting with the topic of this conference, though, my focus today will be on households with mortgages and how their financial health relates to financial stability. So today I'll be talking about two things. The first is why financial stability is important and how the financial health of indebted households can affect it. And second, I'll talk about how the RBA assesses and monitors the financial health of Australians with mortgages and what we find. There has been a lot said and written about the issue of household financial stress in recent times, using a multitude of data sources and reporting on many different individual experiences. Wednesday's national accounts showed how inflation, tax, and interest rates have weighed on real household disposable income. And as RBA Governor Michelle Bullock said when discussing the challenge of inflation following the RBA board meeting this week, high inflation makes life difficult for everyone and damages the functioning of the economy. It erodes the value of savings, hurts household budgets, makes it harder for businesses to plan and invest, and worsens income inequality. The Governor emphasised that the effect of all this is that many households are experiencing a painful squeeze on their finances. Today I'm going to provide an overall picture of the situation, drawing on the RBA's extensive work in this area, which is published in detail in our regular financial stability review. Based on our analysis of a wide range of information, we find that while budget pressures are being widely felt across households, indebted households, most of these households have managed to adjust to these pressures. So while there has been an increase in the number of borrowers who are under severe financial stress, the vast majority of borrowers remain able to cover basic expenses and service their loans. This resilience of indebted households is supporting the stability of the Australian financial system. So let me begin by explaining why that's so important. The RBA has long had a mandate to contribute to financial stability. Over the past quarter century, this has included working closely with the Australian Prudential Regulation Authority, or APRA, and other members of the Council of Financial Regulators to promote stability in the financial system. The proposed revisions to the Reserve Bank Act following the independent review of the RBA will formalise this role by enshrining it in legislation. Financial stability is important because a stable financial system facilitates the smooth flow of funds between savers and investors and thereby helps to promote growth in economic activity. A stable financial system can perform this key economic function even in the face of shocks or stress. The RBA's financial stability objective is therefore intrinsically linked and generally complementary to its objectives for inflation and employment. Financial stress among indebted households has the potential to have a direct impact on financial stability, with all the adverse consequences that financial instability can have on the broader economy and thus households. Housing loans make up nearly half of Australian banks' exposures. Therefore, if a sufficiently large number of mortgagors were to default on their loans, lenders could face widespread losses as a result. If these losses were large enough, this could lead to lenders sharply restricting the supply of credit to even very sound borrowers. This could disrupt economic activity and result in rising unemployment. Unemployment in turn would further increase financial stress among households and businesses, leading to further loan defaults, bank losses, and a pullback in the supply of credit. And if households and businesses were to become concerned that their deposits at banks might not be safe, financial system stability and economic activity will be disrupted further still. Now, it's clear that this feedback between financial stress of indebted households and financial instability, where disruptions to the functioning of the financial system affect the functioning of the economy, would come at high costs for all. I want to be clear, though, that financial stress among households does not automatically imply financial instability. Indeed, there appears to be a low risk that financial pressures currently being experienced by Australian borrowers will translate into financial stability issues. So I'll now step through how we come to that assessment. At the RBA, we spend a lot of time carefully monitoring the financial health of Australian households so that we understand the overall extent of financial stress and how this is likely to evolve. But there is no single definition of financial stress. Rather, financial stress can be best thought of as existing across a spectrum. At the milder end, budget pressures can force households to cut back on discretionary spending, reduce their rate of saving, or draw down on their stock of savings. While unwelcome, most borrowers therefore usually have several means to adjust to budget pressures to avoid or at least delay entering financial stress. Moving along the spectrum, as budget pressures rise or household savings buffers deplete, households worried about being able to pay their bills may find themselves having to cut back expenditure even further, and or resort to finding more work. At the extreme end, households in severe financial stress are then unable to service their debts or pay their essential bills out of their income and savings. Now, first and foremost, this has a significant negative impact on their lives and well-being. But as I described earlier, this tail end of financial stress can also have implications for financial stability. Households' experiences with this spectrum can be very different. There are usually many more households at the milder end than at the extreme end of the spectrum. And this is also the case today. Of the households that do enter severe financial stress, most do so suddenly as a result of a disruptive event, such as illness or job loss. However, in other cases, financial stress can arise more gradually. As some households exhaust their options to adjust to a build-up of budget pressures, they move through different phases of the spectrum towards the extreme end. Most households don't move through the entire spectrum, though. Many are able to take action to avert becoming insolvent. This may be through finding extra work or reducing their discretionary spending. Indebted households may also resolve the situation by seeking temporary hardship assistance from their lender or, often as a last resort and at high personal costs, by reducing or repaying their debt through selling assets, including their family home. These very difficult decisions, first and foremost, help households adjust to financial pressures. But in doing so, they also support stability of the financial system and the economy. To assess how financial stress is building along this spectrum, the RBA closely monitors a broad range of indicators. This recognises that no single metric can capture the full picture, as well as that data quality varies substantially, both across different household groups and along the spectrum of financial stress. Loan arrears and insolvencies allow us to monitor late stages of severe financial stress for indebted households with relative precision and in a timely manner. This includes households owning and operating small businesses. By contrast, there's no universally accepted measure of budget pressures, with many available surveys measuring a range of different concepts. One set of data we use is the loan level data from the RBA's securitisation system. It provides a good guide to the financial position of individual households with mortgages. These data cover one third of all Australian mortgages, so that's almost 2 million loans. Using this data set allows us to estimate the financial positions of indebted households and assess how they could evolve under different scenarios. So what does all this information tell us about the current financial health of Australian households, and for those with mortgages in particular? One thing it tells us is that budget pressures are being felt very broadly across households. We know many have curtailed their consumption and made other adjustments in response. But incidences of severe financial stress, where people are struggling to meet even the most basic expenses, is currently limited to a much smaller group. But starting with the aggregate picture, we know that high inflation and higher interest rates have reduced household spare income. A range of surveys and indicators are consistent with widespread financial pressures and suggest that financial stress is building in its early stages. Households' assessments of their family finances fell sharply in early 2022 with the rise in inflation and interest rates, and has remained near record lows since. And as you can see from the graph, the fall has been greatest for those with mortgages on their home. Google searches of terms related to household financial stress have also trended up, and financial counselling services such as the National Debt Helpline and other community organisations have seen increased demand for their services over the same period. While financial pressures have increased, to date, most households have managed to adjust to these pressures, and they've done so in a number of ways. Some households have managed to increase their hours of work or switch to a higher paying job, supported by the strength in the labour market. So even though most workers have seen a decline in their base wages in real terms, their overall employment incomes have generally held up better. Many households have also had to make adjustments to their consumption, and as a result, consumption growth has been subdued, particularly in per capita terms. And finally, households have also adjusted their savings. After saving much more than usual during the pandemic, households are now saving less than they did on average in the years prior to the pandemic. Indeed, as we set out in October's financial stability review, the share of borrowers who are persistently drawing down on their stock of savings has increased from previous years. Together, all these adjustments have meant that to date, the substantial pressure on households' budgets has not translated into a sharp increase in late-stage financial stress. As you can see on the graph, both loan arrears and personal insolvencies have increased from their low levels during the pandemic, but most households continue to be able to service their debts. Indeed, close to 99% of loans remain on or ahead of schedule. However, we know that budget pressures and incidences of financial stress vary widely across households. This is especially true at the current juncture, where the need for monetary policy to respond to high inflation has caused a sharp increase in interest rates, which has substantially increased mortgage costs. As the graph shows, the majority of mortgagors, except those still on low fixed rates, have seen their minimum scheduled payments increase between 30 and 50%. Since the first increase in the cash rate in May 2022. These borrowers are more likely to have experienced a sharper increase in budget pressures than the overall population. And even within the group of mortgagors, there's some who are experiencing budget pressures more acutely. To understand the extent of budget pressures across mortgagors, we use the loan level data from the RBA's securitisation system that I mentioned before. These data provide very timely information about households' mortgages, what they currently owe, their required payments, and how much they've saved in their offset and redraw accounts, as well as the borrower's income at the point that loan was originated. We then conservatively assume borrowers' incomes have grown in line with the wage price index over time. These data give the most complete picture for variable rate owner-occupier borrowers, because these borrowers, compared with fixed rate or investor borrowers, are most likely to hold their savings in their mortgage accounts. Accordingly, the following analysis that I'm about to talk through relates specifically to variable rate owner-occupier borrowers, who make up around half of all mortgagors and one-fifth of all households. Estimates from the securitisation data show that many borrowers are now devoting a considerably larger share of their income to servicing their debts than in early 2022, when interest rates were at their lowest. Just over 20% of variable rate owner-occupier borrowers are now estimated to devote more than 30% of their income to mortgage payments. And as the graph shows, households with lower incomes are more likely than other borrowers to devote a larger share of their income to servicing their mortgage. In addition, essential expenses also make up a larger share of income for these borrowers. By comparison, households with higher incomes devote a smaller share of their income to essential expenses. So they're typically able to service larger mortgage payments relative to their incomes without encountering financial stress. So while the metric on this graph is often reported as a measure of mortgage stress, it's important to note that it does not provide a complete picture. To better understand, then, the financial pressure a household is facing, we can estimate borrowers' cash flows using the securitisation data, along with the Melbourne Institute's household expenditure measure that provides an estimate of essential expenses given income and family composition. Based on these data, we estimate that around 95% of variable rate owner-occupier borrowers still have spare income after meeting their mortgage payments and essential expenses. So while just over 20% of borrowers are estimated to spend more than 30% of their income on mortgage payments, a much lower share, at around 5%, is estimated to find their income insufficient to cover their mortgage payments and essential expenses. As you can see from the graph, lower income households are more likely to have an income shortfall than borrowers on higher incomes. But we also know from the securitisation data that most of the 5% of variable rate owner-occupier borrowers who we estimate to have an income shortfall do have substantial savings buffers. That is, they have sufficient savings in their mortgage offset and redraw accounts to finance their income shortfalls for some time, which can give them time to explore their options when they're in this situation. This then leaves less than 2% of all variable rate owner-occupier borrowers, as shown in the two left-hand columns on the graph, who have both an income shortfall and low savings buffers, and so could fall into severe financial stress within 6 months, assuming interest rates remain around current levels. Again, lower income borrowers are overrepresented in this group, as shown by the yellow portion of the bar, as are borrowers with higher leverage. Now, these results have all pertained to variable rate owner-occupier borrowers. While we don't have as complete data for fixed rate borrowers, we can use a range of surveys to build a fairly good picture. And this picture is one of similar resilience. Borrowers rolling off fixed rate loans are likely to see similarly sized increases in their mortgage costs as those experienced by variable rate borrowers. But fixed rate borrowers have also avoided higher loan payments for longer. This has allowed them to build up substantial savings buffers on par with those of comparable variable rate borrowers. Consistent with this, loan arrears rates are lower for current fixed rate borrowers when compared with those of variable rate owner-occupier borrowers. And borrowers who've recently rolled off fixed rates have similar arrears rates to other variable rate borrowers. So turning now to what all this means for financial stability. While budget pressures are widespread, most borrowers appear well placed to service their debt and cover essential costs. Indeed, as I've just explained, we estimate that less than 2% of variable rate owner-occupier borrowers are currently at real risk of not being able to cover their basic expenses and mortgage payments out of their current income and don't have significant savings buffers to fall back on. Now, in scenarios where the unemployment rate rises or interest rates increase further, the share of households in severe financial stress would rise. However, given the solid financial position of the bulk of borrowers, most are also expected to be resilient in those circumstances. The data shows this, that even in the event of job loss, where a household would lose all their income, around half of all variable rate owner-occupier borrowers would have enough buffers in their offset or redraw accounts to sustain their scheduled mortgage payments and essential expenditures for at least 6 months. But this scenario is actually quite unlikely for many mortgagors. More than half of households with mortgages have multiple incomes, making it less likely they'd lose their entire household income. So the broader financial stability risks from the household sector do appear contained. Even if the unemployment rate were to increase by 2 percentage points, and that's around 3 to 4 times as sharply as projected in the November 2023 Statement on Monetary Policy, the share of borrowers at risk of running out of savings buffers over the next year or so would likely remain low at single-digit levels. Finally, another important layer supporting households and financial stability is the fact that most households have substantial equity in their homes. Reflecting prudent lending standards under APRA's regulatory framework and the general increase in housing prices over a number of years, much less than 1% of loans are estimated to currently be in negative equity. In the event a household becomes unable to continue servicing their loan, this gives them the option of selling their home and repaying their loan. While this is very disruptive and with real-life costs for the affected households, it does protect both them and their lender against default. Now, there could still be risks to the real economy from high household debt and rising financial pressures on Australian borrowers. But even in a downside economic scenario, high starting levels of borrower resilience, together with high starting levels of equity in housing loans, mean that losses incurred by lenders are likely to remain manageable. Furthermore, APRA's strong prudential framework and supervision means that banks hold high levels of capital and liquidity. This means banks are well placed to withstand such losses while continuing to lend to households and businesses, and thus supporting economic activity even in very challenging conditions. So in conclusion, budgetary pressures are clearly being widely felt, and many households have had to make often difficult adjustments to navigate the challenging economic environment. The number of borrowers in severe financial stress has risen. However, most borrowers have been resilient, and even in the case of an economic downturn, this is likely to remain the case. This, along with the strong position of our financial institutions, helps support the stability of the Australian financial system and our economy. Thank you for listening, and I look forward to answering your questions.
Yeah, thank you, Andrea. That was great. So now it's your chance to ask a representative from the Reserve Bank all the things you've been wondering about. But in particular, I guess, mortgages, but also interest rates and inflation, perhaps. So was there anyone that has something?
Firstly, thanks so much for the interesting presentation. Mark Humphrey-Jenner from UNSW. I wanted to ask a question about fiscal policy. So you've mentioned quite a lot about what the RBA can do, and you started off the speech by talking about, I guess, the impact of things such as inflation, interest rates, and taxation, and how that's eaten into people via bracket creep. So could you perhaps give us an idea about the role of fiscal policy in helping to both, A, get inflation under control, and potentially ways to mitigate bracket creep, and whether something perhaps needs to be done about that?
Look, thank you for the question, but I'll have to refer you to the Governor's previous remarks on that topic. So I'm here today to talk about financial stability and mortgagors' financial health. So we'll stick to that topic, if that's okay.
Thank you for the very interesting briefing. Just following the financial news in North America and Australia as well, the last week suddenly there seems to be people really building in interest rate cuts, weaker job markets, rapidly deteriorating economic outlook. Wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, look, again, I'm afraid I can't comment on the outlook for the economy. So happy to take questions on financial stability and mortgagors' financial health.
Yeah, I'm not going to ask about the next cash rate for sure.
Thank you.
Ali from Monash University. So you said that you have the data on the variable rates, but you couldn't get the data on the fixed rate and you surveyed for that. So I just want to know from the empirical point of view, what are the hurdles to get the fixed rates data?
Right, that's a good question, thank you. And I will, and I can answer it. So I'll start by, the securitization data that we have does have a mix of, the full spread of mortgage types in there. So we do have information on fixed rates loans. The challenge is fixed rate borrowers tend not to hold their savings against their mortgage because those kind of products don't actually allow you to, generally, don't allow you to have offset and redraw accounts. So the challenge is that fixed rate borrowers tend to hold their savings elsewhere where we can't see them in our specific data set. But from the work we have done, and this is set out in detail in our recent financial stability reviews, what we can tell from piecing together the different information we have, so the information we've got from the securitisation data set, the information from various surveys, we do know that fixed rate borrowers have actually built up similar savings buffers as variable rate borrowers. So we do have a fairly good sense of their financial position, and it does seem that, as I said, they are similarly resilient. Certainly in terms of how they've been performing, in terms of continuing to pay their loans as they've rolled off fixed their very low fixed rates, they've been performing on par with variable rate borrowers. So that's kind of reinforcing that there's not, some significant difference in, I suppose, the financial positions of those types of borrowers. So now, of course, no one can tell the future, but from the information we have, these borrowers don't look any different in a risk sense to variable rate borrowers, and that's actually consistent with what the banks themselves are seeing, and you will have seen that in their commentary that that their fixed rate borrower book is performing similarly.
What is the ratio between the fixed rate and variable rate borrowers? Any sort of estimate on that?
So at the moment, the fixed rate share, it's about 20% versus 80%. So the bulk of loans are actually variable rate loans. The share of fixed rate loans did increase significantly in recent years during the pandemic, with interest rates at very low levels, and fixed rate interest rates were actually extremely low and attractive. So there was an increase in the share of fixed rate lending, but that's now coming coming back off, but it remains the case that the bulk of loans are variable rate loans.
That's interesting to know.
Thank you for presentation. This is Akhtar from Australian Catholic University. I have a question to you. Maybe you can answer or not, I don't know yet. So housing price in Sydney, almost double-digit growth this year. Mm-hmm. And then the interest rate grows from last May to now by 4.25%. Even after that, the market is growing, and the house price is growing. Do you have any like inside modeling or whatever you have, any insight you can share with us that why the market is bubbling up like this? We know the answer a little bit, but any insight from RBA?
Yeah, so I think all I would say on that issue, in terms of the dynamics and what's going on in the housing market, it is clear that supply of housing has not kept up with demand. And I think that is why we're seeing such tightness in rental markets and in the established housing market. Beyond that, I just refer you to our latest statement on monetary policy, which talks through that in more detail.
Yeah, thank you. In regard to the previous questions, you said 20% fixed rate.
Yep.
20% fixed rate loans. And that's a very big number in a sense that 50% of our banking exposure is loans, home loans. And that 20% tells you 10% of the exposure of the whole banking market. It's in a big number. Even like many of the fixed rate loans being like converted to variable rate now, but that 20% is still holding maybe a couple of years or something. I don't know exact numbers, but it's still a very big number. And when they convert it to a variable rate, they'll move to 6% plus rate. In that case, do you foresee any stress in the market?
Yeah, look, I would, you know, obviously there are risks, and it's safe to say both ourselves and the banks themselves are monitoring this very closely. But in terms of the assessment we can do of all the information we have, so that the sort of general risk characteristics of these types of borrowers and the kind of savings that they built up, that they don't seem significantly riskier than any other cohort of borrowers. So they're not a concern in themselves, but having said that, you know, time will tell. And so I guess it's not to say there aren't any risks, but I think, and I think this would be sort of a fair characterisation of our assessment of financial stability risks in general, is we're in as good a position as you could hope to be facing into what is undoubtedly a challenging economic environment.
Thank you.
Yes, it's David Tripe from Massey University in New Zealand. One of the obvious issues is that you've got an issue around mortgage product and mortgage product design. When you talk about the way that the Australian banks aren't letting fixed rate borrowers make accelerated payments, that doesn't necessarily apply in other markets. We've been reading stuff about the challenges in the US market, how the prevalence of fixed rate loans there is actually slowed. That prevalence is actually said to get negative impact on housing turnover. And if we look at other countries, one of the obvious contrasts is between Australia and New Zealand, whereas you've got 20% fixed rates in the New Zealand market, it's about 10 or 15% floating rate only. Do you think that you've got some interest in looking at mortgage product design so that you get more efficient pass-through, less disruptive pass-through, and the impacts of changing different mortgage products to design on financial stability?
Right. Look, I would say that is certainly an issue that is considered in the literature, as you suggest. In terms of the challenges here, I think, as we've seen by the behaviour of fixed rate borrowers here, it's not that they're not saving as a result. They are saving just somewhere else, just because of the, as you say, the designer products, but that doesn't stop them saving. I guess the other, I mean, to counter that dynamic and that you're describing about, you know, the, I guess the risk faced by households with variable rate versus fixed rate, one benefit of having variable rate loans is when we do ease monetary policy and cut rates, that flows through to all borrowers immediately, which does help them. So there are different aspects to consider. So I think that's about all I can say on that one. Thank you.
Oh, yeah, there's a few more.
You emphasized a few times the risks associated with fixed versus variable rate borrowing. I'm not so very familiar with the Australian banking system, but when the rates change, can't the borrowers just switch their banks? In particular, if the rate goes down, for example, if I have a fixed payment, can't I just go to another bank, close the first loan, and go forward with the variable?
Yes, you can. And now, depending on the product, there'll be exit fees. So that will, I guess, play into the, I guess, decision of any borrower, whether that is worth their while doing that. But you're right, there are options. It will cost, you know, there may be a fee associated. So that will, you know, I think it's fair to say each individual situation will be different.
Thank you so much. Thank you. It's Lale from Toronto Metropolitan University in Canada. My question is, about the banking system in Australia. Are there any tax-exempt savings for the individuals? Because right now, when it comes to savings, your data hovers only around mortgages, right? So what happens if people, would they have any other venues for saving when they are saving on their mortgage payments?
Yes, so I think that's one of the reasons that we say our analysis is most detailed and for variable rate borrowers, because they tend to save where we can see it. People might save in other types of savings accounts. They might invest in other liquid assets. Now, obviously, there's superannuation where people are saving in a sense as well, but that's not... in the normal course of things, that's not accessible, and that's not a liquid form of saving. But there are certainly many different other places for saving. So that's, I guess, just on the saving point, we've talked about fixed rate borrowers and why we can't see their savings. Investors are another type of borrower who we're unable to do the same precise, the same extent of detailed analysis about, because that is then a tax incentive thing. So that investors, for tax reasons, are actually not incentivized to save against their mortgage, so they tend to save somewhere else. So that's the reason we don't have good visibility of their savings. But once again, as you know, it's not to say these people aren't saving; they're saving in other products. And when we can use surveys to get some sense of that, and you know, there's certainly no sense that in fixed rate and investor borrowers are any riskier. At all. Fixed rate borrowers tend to be on par, and if anything, investors look even more resilient.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Hi, Andrew Grant from the University of Sydney. Are you keeping track of the amount of spending that's going on credit cards, in particular looking at the delinquency rate on credit cards and the rise that is potentially predictive of what's going to happen to the mortgage market? As you know, we might think that's quite a good leading indicator for future mortgage delinquency, and I think we're seeing a large growth in the amount of spending on credit cards and a real rebound of the industry. So I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on, you know, how long the effects of this inflationary period are going to take to flow through to the economy. Thanks.
So I guess just on the issue of credit cards, so that tends, and delinquencies in that space and personal loans, that tends to be a big feature in the reporting and analysis of developments in the United States, and that's because those products play a much larger role there. In Australia, those products have basically, personal loans and credit card use has been in trend decline, just because actually it's much easier to use, basically draw on your mortgage because of these offset and redraw accounts. It is very easy to save there and then withdraw it as you need it. So it's basically, you end up effectively with a lower interest rate by accessing liquidity that way. So they tend not to be heavily relied on, that, although, as you said, you know that they are still potentially a leading edge. The work we've done, there hasn't been a substantial increase in the amount of outstanding credit card debt accruing interest, because most people, the bulk of people, just because of this sort of structural trend decline in credit card use, you tend to use it basically and pay it off in full each month, so it's not used as a source of credit as such. And we haven't seen substantial increases in the outstanding credit card debt accruing interest. So that gives a sense that that's not as big an issue here. Having said that, I mean, as my speech made clear, that there's a wide... I mean, I'm talking about in the aggregate and from a financial stability lens. There is obviously a wide variation across the experience of different households. So in making these comments, I'm not wanting at all to suggest that there isn't, there has been an increase in the number of households in severe financial stress. We have seen, some households looking to use these products more to make ends meet, but it is still a small share of households, and actually the bulk of households have remained resilient. So I guess that's just to recognise there is a wide range of experiences. There are undoubtedly people in severe financial stress, and I don't want to detract from their situations at all. They have, you know, there's real life, personal and financial consequences for those people. But when you take that broader lens, when you're looking for financial stability risks, which is what we're doing, it remains the case that the bulk of households continue to be able to make ends meet and service their debts and their essential costs.
Thank you very much for the question. Thank you very much for this presentation. Hi, I'm Yao Hui. I'm from Nanyang Tech in Singapore. So I have two questions. So the first question I have is related to the story of fixed and floating interest rates. Because as an economist, we go by something called the Euler equation, which is effectively talking about real interest rate equals to nominal interest rates minus inflation expectations. So in this current environment, whereby there's an increase in these inflation expectations, we will expect for those fixed interest rate holders, the real interest rate will go down. So they are better off. So it's so possible that they can actually change their consumption patterns as well. So I'm wondering, is there any data or any evidence of changes in consumption patterns for those fixed interest rates borrowers? Because they might not be saving, because they might want to spend, because they're better off as compared to others. This is the first question. And the second question I have in mind is talking about what we call the hand-to-mouth of people. So in the economics literature as well, there's this term called hand-to-mouth. So for hand-to-mouth people, it's effectively those that spend money, whatever they have, they'll just spend altogether. So in this lowest end of the spectrum, so is there any so-called work being done to study how to help this hand-to-mouth literature, hand-to-mouth people in this current environment as well? Yeah, those are my two big questions I have. Thank you.
Right, thank you. So on the first question about differing consumption patterns across fixed rate and variable rate borrowers, the analysis that we've done in my team, we don't have access to that data, but I know there are other parts of the Reserve Bank that are poring over all the consumption data we do have. So what I could do is I'd refer you to our recent statement on monetary policy and all the different cuts and distinctions we can make between different consumption patterns are set out there. So I'd refer you to that. And so I'm going to have to ask, your second question was about, could you just repeat it, sorry?
So my second question is about the hand-to-mouth consumers. Hand-to-mouth in the sense that whenever they have the money coming in,
yep.
they'll get it out straight away. So it's hand-to-mouth.
Yep.
This is what I use in economics.
Yeah.
So for this hand-to-mouth literature, for these people, is RBA doing anything to monitor them? And what can be done to help them?
Yeah, so I guess we certainly, as I've explained, and you can look in our latest financial stability review in much detail, we are trying to, we have, I guess, as best we can with the data we have, analyse the cash spare cash flows. So I think that's what you're talking about. So people with very limited spare cash flows, once you take into account debt servicing costs and their basic expenses, we are monitoring the share of households in that position. And so, as I mentioned from the results, we estimate that around 5% of borrowers are in that position. And we are monitoring it very closely. Now, one comment I would make here is, as I've said, this analysis is based on those people with mortgages. So actually, there will be some people in that position that you've described that actually don't have mortgages. They can't afford the mortgage. They're actually renters. And as I said, and actually renters do tend, by comparison with mortgages, to have mortgagors, to have lower incomes and lower saving levels, so they are actually potentially more likely to be in that position. The data set we've got that I've been describing, that analysis, that doesn't have, we can't analyse their cash flows in the same way we can for borrowers, just because we don't have the data. But there's lots of survey information out there, and the all the analysis that we've done in this space, you will find there's been recent bulletin articles that we've published, the Reserve Bank. So if you go to our website, there's a good bulletin article about analysing the situation of renters there, and as well in the latest statement on monetary policy. As to what monetary policy could do about that, I think, monetary policy is a certain tool for a certain job, and I think that the thing to emphasise here is that inflation actually hurts everyone. And that's why it reduces people's real income. It damages the functioning of the economy, and that's why it's so important that, that's why the board's priority continues to be get inflation down back to the target. So I think that's probably all I've got to say on that one. But yeah, there's a lot of good analysis we've done and published. So have a look at the website.
Thank you so much, Andrew. Should we give an applause for this great discussion?
Thank you.